remember I got attacked very aggressively by someone on LinkedIn. What sometimes hurts me is that whenever there is an issue or a challenge or a problem to solve in a business, people just look for answers and frameworks. Why is MBTI so popular, for example, to just, pile on a debate that gets every psychologist angry? Because it's simple, right? And because people get it. A lot of organizations love that kind of language. And psychometricians will be like, no, why are you doing this? A lot of evidence against doing something like unconscious bias training. A lot of resources that will undoubtedly show you that unconscious bias training most of the times has no impact whatsoever on the behavior of people.
Welcome to the Psych and Success Podcast, your favorite voice of business psychology. I am your host, Trithika Kashyap, and this has been a much-awaited episode for me, as we are joined by Gabrielle Glassy, a prominent figure in the field of business psychology. Starting in the fast-paced media industry, Gabrielle made a strategic leap, becoming a professor at Kingston at Birkbeck University. Now, as a head of people and organizational development at Wise, a company with one of the best work cultures globally, he is on a mission to transform work cultures. We will dive into the harsh and the sweet reality, and also the future of organizational psychology. So let us begin. Hi, Gabrielle. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast, Psych and Success.
Thank you for having me, and hello to you.
In this podcast, because it is based on business psychology and the next generation leaders, you were one of the most, for me, most wanted guest for the podcast, because you are yourself an organizational psychologist. You have been in academia, you have been in the corporate side. So I have loads and loads of questions. And me being a management psychologist myself, I'm very curious to learn from you, to learn the world of organizational psychology, and to learn from your experience. So
sounds good.
Yeah. So why don't you first start by introducing yourself for the audience?
Yeah, all right. So everybody calls me Gab. So that's kind of like what I go with.
From now on.
No, it's okay. Actually, so my name is Gabriele. But in Italian, it's a very common name. And then outside of Italy, it's not as common. So I noticed when I moved to the UK many, many years ago that people were struggling to understand, and they were like, I'm confused. This sounds like a woman's name. And I'm like, okay, well, let's just go with Gab. Everybody seemed to find it easy. So I'm from Italy originally. I moved to the UK in 2010, and I haven't always been in psychology. The first chunk of my career, I worked in television. So I had a few jobs in production companies in Rome. And then I did a stunt at Fox International Channels, which was a very popular sort of entertainment network on PTV. And that was also in Rome. Yeah, yeah. And then I moved to the UK, and originally it was to work at the BBC with a similar job, because I had a business job. So I was first in sales, then in acquisitions, and at the BBC, I was overseeing the BBC brand in certain territories. So first I did Southern Europe, and then I did a part of Northern Europe that we used to call Benelux. So Belgium and Netherlands, which near Luxembourg, which had a very rich TV panorama. But I guess as work was going really well, when I was around 30 or so, I started asking myself if that's what I really wanted. I sort of ended up working in TV, because it was an industry in Rome back in my days I don't know if it is as much anymore, but back then it was. So it was a good opportunity. I loved entertainment. I've always loved music, television, cinema, etc. So so I just started doing it. And when I started managing teams and getting to more complex layers of work, I got more and more fascinated by leadership, by team management, and I love Lamy and development.
Okay.
So I started thinking, well, what if I do like a drastic change? I started imagining that I can actually have a second career in something else. And so I first studied education at Birkbeck. I did master's just to get my head into it. And I was really passionate about a lot of social issues as well. This particular course was very focused on education and social change. So it was very, very interesting. And it gave me also like an intro into the education world in the UK. And when I finished that, more or less, there was an opportunity at the BBC that presented itself to me. They were looking for somebody to lead the Sales Academy, which was essentially a development initiative that would have taken the sales force of the BBC, which is all the people that did the exploitation of the BBC brand outside of the UK, to the next level. So learning new sales techniques and negotiation skills. And I was really well positioned. I was successful at my job, and my boss was telling me, I want to make a good example out of you. And so if there is anything that you desire, tell me, because I want to reward you for how good you've been.
Wow.
So, yeah, it took me a week or so. And then I gathered the courage and I said to him, I want to leave your team. And I want to leave this career, and I want to become a trainer. And he said, yes. Like, if that's what you want, I cannot imagine anyone better than you to actually do this particular job. It was an internal move, so I think it was also inspired enough as a lead to understand that it was a good use of my skills and talent, because that's really where I wanted to go. And the head of organizational development there was also very happy to have me, because I had a lot of street credit. And he thought I could learn everything else. But he said to me, I also want you, though, to study organizational psychology. And I want you to become a fully rounded professional. What about that? And I thought, why not? Yeah, let's do it. I love learning.
Yeah.
And that's how we started, right? So I took the job and I started building this sales academy, which very soon became a lot more than just, the kind of training that I mentioned to you. I started getting involved in leadership development, and I started getting involved in, the organizational design and development side of things when it came to the sales division. In the meantime, I was studying. So I did my master's at Kingston, attending lectures over the weekend, studying in airport lounges, in hotels around the world, and a lot of life.
That sounds very fancy or very...
Yeah, I should be aware of that, but I don't mean it that way. You know, I mean it in a sense that it was really tiring, because... I was traveling all around. This was pre-COVID. So trainers used to travel a lot. I had to deliver training in Sydney, Hong Kong, Singapore, Mumbai, New York, LA, Miami. And I know it sounds glamorous, but trust me, you don't want to fly all the way to Sydney and then go to your hotel, shower, and deliver an 8-hour management course, right?
Well, it's tiring for you, all the travel, and then... Because training also requires a lot of energy in you.
Yeah, definitely. My God, I wish that they taught you that in school, how to self-regulate and manage your energy. And no, like nobody taught me. It took me a long time, and you know, especially when I started going into coaching and more one-to-one work, I really felt the weight of it. And but the liberating training is fall, like you have to hold the space for a group of people for a long time, and most learners are vulnerable, you know, so you need to be very centered, because otherwise you're going to carry that energy with you even after the training is over. Yeah.
Oh, okay. That has been quite a journey that you have traveled, from all the way from media to getting into, you know, the sales team to the leadership development that now you are into. And how, because I know that you have also worked in academia, and now you're working back in the corporate setup. How was the change for you, like being a corporate guy and then coming to academia and then again moving to the corporate life?
Yeah, I think because of the stress that my first job in the field brought, and, you know, all the studying that I had to do. When I handed in my dissertation at the end of my master's, I resigned from the BUC, and I decided to start working by myself as a freelancer. I wanted to explore more than just media. Keep in mind that until then, even though I changed career, I had stayed in the same industry. So I was really curious to understand, how do I apply my skills to a bank or a charity or a factory? And the only way to achieve that was to be a consultant. I also really wanted to be independent, and I wanted to be by myself for a while. So I started my own business called the Business Psychology Network. And right when I started, my dissertation supervisor asked me if I was up for doing some lectures on learning and development in practice, because learning and development is a subject that is taught in master's degrees in occupational and business psychology, but from a theoretical point of view. So they were interested in getting the practitioner side of things. And I was totally up for it. I loved my master's. I loved my lectures. I loved studying at Kingston. It was a good couple of years, although very tiring. And so I thought, yeah, why not? And yeah, and as I started doing it, I developed a lot of interest and passion for the relationship that I could establish with my students, but also having to teach kind of prompted me to study all over again and go deeper and deeper into research and trying to bridge between research and practice, and how do I bring my own experience and how do I keep it thorough though and academic, you know, for the students, yeah, that they could get both worlds. And so progressively I started doing more and more. And so it was an assignment that started as a teaching to part-time students, and then it became also the full-time. And then I started taking charge of the whole module. And I wouldn't say, I've never seen myself as an academic, but, you know, I'm this very weird hybrid where in the academic world, I think people can see that I understand and I can hold a conversation with them. I can read research papers and I can use them, but nobody would consider me an academic. And in the professional world, sometimes people at work call me Professor Gab, because the way that I talk about psychology, sometimes they're like, oh, there we go, the professor is starting, right? So I'm a hybrid, I would say. Nobody would consider me, you know, part of their world fully.
In both the areas.
Exactly. And so I was doing both, right? To answer your question, I was lecturing, and then I started lecturing at Birkbeck as well in the undergraduate. I did the master's in org psychology as well. Always around development, career counseling, and coaching, and that prompted me to continue to study. I also, because I hadn't studied psychology as an undergraduate, I also did my bridge year with a BPS accredited course. So I did the sort of top up and got a degree in psychology as well. And then I started doing my my coaching training too, which I took very seriously because I'm incredibly passionate about coaching, and it was a skill that was required of me as a freelancer as well, very, very often. So I did also a lot of coaching training too. Yeah.
Okay. That's interesting. So and about the coaching stuff, because I am now planning to get into that. So I will talk to you about that later. And when you're talking about academia and the practical aspect that you were getting into it, because as per my research, what I have seen is the researches which are happening in the academic world are not really being used by the, you know, the corporates, the world outside. What do you have to say about that? And were you yourself were able to get the researches out there for the people to actually implement them in the corporate setup?
Well, I'd have so much to say about that. I think I think about it every day. And it's because, how can I say, like, that? Let me try and do an analogy. So imagine, like, this is something that a lot of my friends who are doctors, my medical doctors, tell me that it's a conclusion that they got to as well, that if, you know, we could look at a patient with a lot of different heads thinking holistically about what that person is going through, we would have revolutionized the world of medicine, right? Like, if your back pain could be looked at by a physiotherapist, a massage therapist, a neurosurgeon, a general doctor, etc. Like, you would have the most amazing diagnosis of what is going on with you. And it would be so much easier to find some relief from your pain. And I think the same applies to our world. It is never just one thing. And so I am very upset at academia for most of the times, because there are some very good exceptions, but most of the time staying in their ivory tower, releasing papers that, trust me, when you get out of the education system, you cannot even access, right? Because, like, it's almost impossible unless you spend a lot of money and you build, like, a very complex network of, like, subscriptions to have the same access to research papers that you have when you're a student or when you're a lecturer. Not to mention that a lot of research papers never get translated into, you know, actual language that people speak. So it's incredibly difficult for a lot of people to understand what a research paper is actually saying, right? And then you go on the practitioner side of things, and psychology is abused in the world. You know, there's a lot of people that use psychology without having the right education, and organizational psychology is no exception. There's a lot of people that do a lot of stuff with psychological foundation who understand nothing about psychology. And I don't think I would like everyone to have a degree in psychology, but perhaps a bit more education around why certain things should be done in a certain way. I think the conflict at the end is that everybody's got this evidence-based term in their mouth. And even in organizational realities, a lot of people are like, oh, we're evidence-based, or we want to work evidence-based, but nobody understands that actually reading evidence and using evidence is incredibly complex. And the world of business, the world of organizations, has an urge to simplify, has an urge to constantly adapt whatever they see to, you know, a pragmatic reality, which the world of academia doesn't always allow. No academic that has a sane approach to psychology will ever have a dogmatic approach to it. I mean, there's a lot of people that, you know, are very dogmatic, but in general, like, a good academic is not dogmatic and will say, I've done this research, I've analyzed, you know, like, a million data points. However, these are the limitations of my research. And this is what is needed in order to understand this better. This is what came before me, but this is what should come after my research, right? that kind of discourse doesn't really stick in organizations where there is pressure to deliver, there's like quarterly objectives, and there's like, give me numbers, give me results, tell me that everybody's done the training, tell me that the training is being impactful, tell me that I've invested my money well, right? And you can't just go and say, well, you know, there's this variable to consider and this other thing to consider, because there's not a lot of respect in business for that kind of language. It's like, no, give me the, you know, give me the binary answer, yes or no, you know?
Okay. So because in psychology, I remember my professor always said the answer to the question, most of the question in psychology is, it depends.
Yeah. Well, they're trained to use tentative language, you know, to really, you know, formulate sentences in a way that you always leave space for things to happen, yeah, or things to be, I guess, like developed or contradicted even, yeah?
Yeah.
The business world doesn't like this.
So how would you say that if you were to advise the business world or any of the leaders who can actually make a change in it, what would you advise them to so that they actually implement the research work and they make it evidence-based as they say it to be?
What I try to do in my job is to always start from a place of questioning things and researching them. And I understand that not everybody can do that or not everybody likes to do that. Well, I think what sometimes hurts me is that whenever there is an issue or a challenge or a problem to solve in a business, people just look for answers and frameworks. Why is like MBTI so popular, for example, like to just, you know, like pile on a debate that gets every psychologist angry? Because it's simple, right? And because people get it. So everybody, I mean, it's a gross generalization, but a lot of organizations love that kind of language. And psychometricians will be like, no, you know, why are you doing this? And it's really difficult to find, you know, like a point where those two mindsets can move, right? So for me, for instance, when you talk about MBTI, and say, for example, you're a freelancer or you even working on an organization where, you know, you don't get to choose the kind of assessment that you use in development or in coaching, then how do you represent yourself and your education and your values in a way that can compromise with this, right? And I remember I got attacked very aggressively by someone on LinkedIn on this exact debate. But I remember as a freelancer, sometimes I was asked to work with tools that I knew were not scientific.
Yeah.
And then my intention was, so how can I make sure that I don't compromise on my values, but I also don't, you know, completely reject this?
Yeah.
So for me, my approach was to just make sure that people knew that as a psychologist, for example, I didn't really endorse that tool as a scientific tool, and that I didn't exactly believe that, for example, yeah, something in particular, like a particular assessment could have like much of the validity, and I would even maybe include resources if people wanted to check why I was saying that. But I could still find a lot of ways to use that tool to do good development. And so, you know, in a way, I clarified my position. I made sure that I said, I don't think, and a lot of the scientific community doesn't really think that this is assessing your personality. However, how can we use it today in order to have a meaningful conversation about what your results, for example, trigger in you, or what kind of response do you have to, you know, this assessment saying that you are a person that does this or does that. Perhaps, you know, like in other situations, such as, for example, using the wrong tool in order to hire someone, no, then I would be like more, no, I don't want to be part of this because I think it's unethical, right? But in development, I think you can make a lot of compromises. And so that is my advice. Continue to compromise because I don't think this is ever going to change. But what you can do as a practitioner is you can bring your truth without being dogmatic about it also, right? Like, so you can express your opinion. You can say, I don't believe in this, or I don't believe in that, or there's a lot of evidence against this. But then also accept that sometimes a client or the business in which you work will say, it doesn't matter, we still want to do it. And then find the way to be the best psychologist you can be with the tools that you're given.
Oh, okay. And when you say that corporates are generally very number-driven, very result-oriented, very like quick things, like do it right now, where the results. So do you think having that non-dogmatic mindset and really putting in your mind into whatever resources are available, do you think that mindset would be able to be adopted by the corporates who are very like in the moment?
I think it depends on your role and depends on how much leverage you have on what you do. I like to think that I can talk to my boss and we can agree on things. So I know I can, you know, say what I think, and I know I can also then, you know, take measurements and understand where I want to position myself. But I'll give you an example. A lot of organizations want to do D&I training. It's a giant topic, right? But I think if we want to generalize and summarize super high level, there's a lot of organizations that have tried to position diversity as something that needs to be done because it will ultimately generate more profit. And there's a lot of professionals in the field of D&I that will tell you, actually, no, the first reason why you should do this is because it's the human thing to do and it's the right thing to do. And also when it comes to training, if you look at the evidence, there's a lot of evidence against doing something like unconscious bias training. A lot of resources that will undoubtedly show you that unconscious bias training most of the times has no impact whatsoever on the behavior of people. And actually, in some cases, it even angers people because it just surfaces limitations that they have in their thinking process and the way that they approach certain topics. And they'll just almost like antagonize, right? Rather than actually thinking, okay, then I'll make a change, or I know how to make a change.
Well,
so what do you do if you work in an organization that says, going to unconscious bias training because, you know, we have decided, and I'm not talking about my organization because luckily they listened to me when the time came. But, you know, what do you do if you're in that kind of situation? Well, you can take a position and you can say, no, it doesn't work. I don't want to do it.
Or
you can try and work around it. And so you can try and, for example, use the evidence that is there to show that behaviors are generally not impacted and try and come up with a solution for them. So for instance, you know, pair unconscious bias training with diversity coaching, or perhaps focus on certain leaders or certain champions or influencers within the organization that can talk about unconscious biases a bit more than what you can do in a training. And therefore you can try and, you know, come up with solutions and design solutions that will make up for what you know is ultimately not going to impact the behaviors of anyone. You can also choose to just do unconscious bias training, knowing it will have no impact, because chances are that in some organizations, that's all they want from you. But I think as psychologists, we kind of have a duty to be as ethical and as fair as possible. So, yeah, that's what I mean, right? Like, you can just say, okay, I'll do it. And, you know, you'll just pretend you don't know that it's bullshit, probably, and it's not going to work. Or you can say, all right, so you want me to do it, but I want it to be impactful. So I'll do what you ask me, but then I'll build some stuff around it that will make sure that I can be impactful. even if you don't know that I'm doing it, you know?
Okay, that's actually pretty smart. Plus, I mean, as you say, I have experience, not just in DEI, but the training setup, because I come from the training industry, that for companies, it has been a tick in the box. And that's about it. They do not really, I mean, there are companies who care, but then there are a lot of companies who just want, okay, this is done. This is just for the employee branding that we are doing, that we are very diverse and inclusive as a company. But in the inside, it's not really the same story.
Mm-hmm.
And so, because this was a question that I wanted to ask first, but it's not too late. Organizational psychology as a term, and you know, this study had started and the industry had started in the early 20th century. And even now we are on the 21st century today, even the new age careers, you know, like be it ethical hacking, be it social media marketing, those have become so popular and gained so much traction. So why is it that organizational psychology couldn't gain that popularity? And also, I would want you, for the listeners, to explain what organizational psychology is as a layman. Because a lot of people, even when I tell them that I'm a management psychologist, they're like, oh, so you conduct therapy sessions. Are you like a psychologist? And so can you, for everybody, help them understand what organizational psychology is?
No, the reality is it's got nothing to do with therapy. It really doesn't even have a lot of like touch points with therapeutic approaches, unless you go down the route of coaching psychology, which has a place in organizations. But I think the definition changes, and every country has legislated around organizational psychology in a different way. So in the UK, for example, it's called the only category that is protected and recognized by the British Psychological Society is the term occupational psychology. But then this is also in the same sort of kind of realm called organizational psychology or business psychology. And every country, actually in the States, it's called industrial organizational psychology, I/O psychology. So every country has legislated differently and come up with different labels. But I would say the short answer is this is psychology applied to the workplace. It's just that then psychology applied to the workplace can take a lot of different directions. And so, yeah, to mention stuff that we have mentioned in this conversation before, psychometrics and assessment, learning and development, but there's also well-being, there is also organizational development, and there's so much within that umbrella term, right? That management psychology, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, there's even the HR parts can come into that. So there's just so much. And just for the audience, I mean, for every term that has been mentioned, there are different professionals for that.
Yeah, the BPS in the UK, for example, accredits courses that have a certain curriculum. So if you want to study occupational psychology in the UK, in courses accredited by the BPS, you will follow a certain curriculum. And then if you want to go outside of the BPS accreditation, then there are different courses where you can study even robotics, you know, and psychology applied to robotics, or psychology applied to negotiation or sales, right? Like there's so many, like work is like life, you know, there's so many, it's like saying life, you know, like there's so many different directions. But I think, the important thing to remember is psychology applied to the workplace. And that's how I always define it when people ask me, so what does it mean? Say it means that I can apply principles of psychology to the workplace. And by the way, organizational psychology was mainly born out of the need to predict performance. And that's, you know, where it all started. And most of the studies, most of the research at the beginning, at the, you know, in the first few decades, was really focusing on this. How can we predict performance? How can we take an individual and understand as much as possible if they're a good investment or not? Although I'm making a gross generalization by saying this, but that was the intention, right? And then other things added on top of that.
Okay. And would you want to answer the question, why was it that organizational psychology as a profession, even when it was about performance analysis and understanding employees and their behavior, why did it not gain as much traction, even though it was like one of the most important or the core things in the corporate setup?
Well, I think the answer is very long, and probably I will not be able to give you, you know, the correct answer. But in my head, I have thought about it so many times. I think professional bodies could do more. I think there's a lack of work and lobbying in governments, in organizations. And I think us alone struggle to demonstrate our value in organizations. And professional bodies could definitely do more about this. I'm passionate about that. I'm a member of the BPS. I was also a member of the ABP, the Association for Business Psychology in the UK. So I've contributed as much as I could to the debate, but I think it's a struggle. And I don't think that many of them have found a way to really lobby and, you know, unite their power and have a voice in the country. In the UK, in my experience, but honestly, like the country where I come from is even worse off, right? In terms of understanding and awareness. So that's one. And then I also think that psychology, just like any other science, but probably psychology even more so, is not an exact science. And the beauty of our job is that we need to understand that humans are complex. And so as much as we want to say that falling in a certain percentile means that your cognitive ability will determine your performance is probably, you know, well evidenced and true, but equally there are aspects to that that don't take into consideration, I don't know, like team dynamics or social skills of the people that you select. And yes, certain personality traits are absolutely more conducive to performing certain jobs, but then people live. People have experiences and things change and circumstances change around them. And even if we believe the personality traits are fixed, it will still be very, very complex to absolutely say, you know, this is exactly what is going to happen with these individuals. Academia being difficult to access is definitely another reason. A lot of us make the mistake of just closing themselves into these rooms where, you know, these rooms are like almost like self-sustained, you know, like the debate never leaves those rooms. And so academia doesn't really know how to work with organizations in a lot of cases. Yeah, I mean, I could talk for hours about this, so I'll stop here.
Yeah, so I see that it's a deep-rooted, very heartful thing to you, that it is not as popular as it is supposed to be. And, you know, also one of the reasons why I started this podcast was to get all the academic work and the researchers out there and get their voices out so that it reaches the corporate setup. The gap can be bridged. Okay, so now that I know that you work with one of the companies who were awarded as to have the best cultures, work cultures around the globe. So what does it take for a company to reach there?
You know what, like, you know, I want to be honest around this and also say, you know, I don't think that anyone has you know, single-handedly the power to determine organizational culture. It's a very organic, living phenomenon where, you know, things may change, things may transform and evolve, and it, you know, it's macro organism made of people and dynamics among these people and the business and the reality, the context around this business constantly changing and being threatened. So it's a very dynamic thing, and I don't think it's static. I don't think you can say, right, we got an amazing culture, job done, let's not worry about it anymore, right? But I think that in the case of Wise, everybody is very, very driven towards our mission, which is essentially what we call Mission Zero. So making money go around the world in a transparent, convenient, and fast. And yep. It's as simple as that. All of us who are clients of Wise have seen this happening. We know how faster and more convenient and more transparent moving your money is.
I have used it multiple times. That has been my go-to. Wise has been my go-to thing.
Exactly. So it's a very clear product in a sense, right? And there's an obsession for the customer, an obsession for the customer experience. And everybody is aligned towards this. And that makes the work environment incredibly clear, if you like. When I worked as a freelancer and I used to do interventions with leadership teams, I used to do an exercise where I asked them to ask their own teams, how do we pay the bills? And how can you, I guess, connect everybody's purpose to the business purpose? And there are some organizations that struggle enormously to link up the work of a single individual to what the company is trying to achieve, because they're gigantic, because they're lost in hierarchy, processes, and structure over structure, so that a lot of people feel almost alienated by the entire context and very distant from what the business actually does. And that doesn't happen at Wise. I think that's definitely one secret, I would say, to the kind of culture that we have. It's also a no-bullshit kind of place. And so remember when we were saying stuff about, you know, like ticking the box and like, for example, delivering development because it ticks the box?
Yeah.
I've never done anything like that at Wise. People just don't engage unless you can prove that what you're doing actually contributes to achieving the mission. And making them faster, making them more efficient, making them more focused on the mission that everybody has got so clear in their mind. So, yeah, I think that's something that I really value, because for me as well, it makes my job incredibly difficult, but in a super stimulating way. I can never really fake it. I can never really say, no, you have to do this. And we co-create with the business a lot. So right now we're in the middle of redefining our performance management approach. We're also developing a lot of stuff around leadership development. And we don't design anything unless we have talked to the business. And by that, I mean, we have involved our people partners. We call them people partners. They're like HR business partners in a lot of organizations.
Yeah.
And we have managed to design thinking sessions with people from the business, co-created co-creation forums, run interviews, and really, really listen to the different functions in the business. What is it that they want? How can performance management help them get healthier teams, high-performing teams? How can leadership develop in a way that is conducive to achieving the mission? So I think that's very healthy as well. That's not a big healthy thing that I see at Wise.
Okay. So I see. So it's majorly what I see is for the company, for the management level, to have the aim, or you can say the product of the company, so clear that you have delivered the same clarity and the same mission and vision to all your employees collectively, so that they know what they're working towards. And so in your experience, because you have also worked as a consultant, as a freelancer, what's the most absurd or that you felt really weirded out by, you know, any of the asks of your clients in your journey?
Well, I don't know if I can answer this question. But I can tell you that even then, you know, you can being a psychologist, being an ethical sort of psychologist means that you can challenge the brief. And so there have been circumstances where I've been asked to do something and I have said, I need to talk to your team first. I am not going to take the brief from you.
Yeah.
Just because you think that that's what your team needs. I want to talk to your team first. And when I finish my interviews and I've collected my data and I've surfaced some themes, I'm going to come back to you and I'm going to tell you if your brief was correct or if there are adjustments that we need to make because, you know, perhaps your team is not aligned. So even when I got requests to do certain things, if I didn't believe in them, I have tried a very consultative coaching approach. And I have just said, I see what you say. I'm going to do it. But in order to make sure that your money is well invested, please allow me to do this, this, and that. And I'll tell you more, sometimes I've done it for free because a lot of organizations don't want to pay you for it, right? So I've included interview time and shadowing. Before COVID, I used to shadow a lot. And I used to ask, can I just spend a day in the office? And some, you know, like you can't just say and pay me X thousand pounds, you know, like to be there, because there's just like, no, hold on a second. I called you. I told you what I wanted you to do. And now, yeah, so a lot of times I've done it for free because I thought this is how I'm going to have an impact. And so I'm going to spend a day. You know, I remember one example, just spending a day in a factory where people were packing things, which to me was so alien because I never even had that experience myself. I come from a privileged background in a sense. So even when I was working as a student in high school, I worked at a hotel reception, you know, like I never did any manual. And so for me as a psychologist, understanding how I could help when it came to manual work was incredibly challenging because I didn't have any shared experience. And also, like, you know, there is research around it. There's a lot of research, but I just felt very exposed. And I remember just asking, can I just spend a few days with them? And can I see what they do, how they talk to each other, what the work entails? And so that's how I feel like when I answer, you know, that question. Even if the brief is absurd, your job is to persuade consultatively in a coaching mindset your client.
Yeah. And what do you think the future of organizational psychology in this changing, transformative workplace looks like? And especially, you know, with this advent of technology and the shifting job market.
I don't see a future, to be honest. But that doesn't mean that it's going to die. Well, I think it's going to evolve into something else. I think neuroscience is advancing so much. In artificial intelligence as well, I mean, I feel so ignorant about the topic. I mean, I'm just scratching the surface and understanding, you know, how to leverage it in my work. But you don't have to be a genius to see how, you know, so much of what we used to study so hard to be able to do will be done by machines very, very easily. you know, like imagine thematic analysis of interviews, like how many hours have you spent learning how to do thematic analysis? And that's it. Like, you don't need it anymore. You know, like somebody, like, yeah, a machine is going to do it for you. And psychometric profiles, you know, like machines will become more and more sophisticated about building more and more accurate profiles. And so, you know, all the time that we spent learning how to interpret results and deliver them in a coaching session, I don't think that's where we're going to be focusing. And I don't feel bitter about it. I just think it's an evolution, right? It's going to evolve. And I hope there's always going to be space for humans to add their touch, you know, and consider myself lucky because I was born in an era where I could really use all of myself to do my job. I had to work on my heart. I had to work on my soul. I had to work on my intellect, my mind, my ability to self-regulate my emotions, my ability to stay rational, my ability to use research, but also use my guts. Like, all of this, I'm grateful that I could learn and practice. I'm not sure 40 years from now, that is what is going to be required of people that go through a career similar to mine. Probably careers similar to mine wouldn't even exist. So,
very long time.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's what I mean.
You've taken over us, the humanity, already.
Well, actually, people say that in 2-3 years, we're going to see a revolution that, you know, has never seen before. That the earth has never seen before, you know, humanity has never seen before. So I don't know, but I think, I don't think it's going to exist the way that I know it. I think it's going to evolve. But that doesn't mean that studying it, for example, is relevant. I'm always very, very intrigued by, you know, people that have, you know, this kind of curriculum, behind them. I think, for instance, what it does to you is that it allows you to really analyze every situation in a systematic, methodical way that a lot of people can't do. You know, like HR is a world full of people that have learned on the job.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of people that have like degrees in HR working in HR. And the difference that, you know, studying organizational psychology can make for you is that if you actually find yourself working in an HR team, you're always going to be able to start from nothing and build an empire, you know, of frameworks, approaches, and solutions. Even if you have zero experience in any organization, you will know where to go, what to research, what to look at, how to put it together, how to collect the evidence, how to translate evidence into practice. You will know all of these things, and for that, I'm eternally grateful.
And I mean, let alone the 40 years later, 10 years later, what organizational psychology would look like. How does it look like for you? Has it, when you started it, has it evolved with time, or also that have you seen, like, the new people coming in, let's say Gen Z coming into organization psychology, are their approach different towards it? Have you seen a difference of how it has evolved and how the new generation people coming in bringing their own angle and perspective to it?
I'm thinking about my students, and I'm thinking about, you know, like, stuff that I've discussed with them. I don't know. I think maybe the time span for me is too short to like observe, you know, like gigantic leaps. But for sure, a couple of things come to mind. So the first one is that I never really realized how white and Western psychology has been for a long time. And I think that's changing. I still remember a brilliant student in my course that made it a point to really just use sources that had been published by researchers of a diverse background, like non-white researchers, let's put it this way.
Yeah.
And I admire her so much for doing that, because it took an enormous effort, right, to identify those researchers, because, like, obviously, researchers are not categorized by their ethnicity, right?
Yeah.
And I just thought that's great. You know, I wish more people started doing that to raise awareness around the fact that most of the studies that we have are studies that are being conducted in certain environments, and those environments are usually Western, and you know, and the majority of the people are white and from a privileged background. So, and organizational psychology is guilty of this more than other branches of psychology, because of the business, I guess, context as well. So that's something that I think is changing, and there is an awareness. And I think, you know, Black Lives Matter in a student context, in a university context, has done that to a certain extent.
Right.
Yes, I think it's amazing. And I cannot wait to see what kind of revolution this brings to our understanding of human beings in the workplace and to D&I in general as well, which is very primitive, you know, compared to where it could go. And then I guess the other thing is probably around COVID and the impact that it had on our ways of working. I'm very confused about what is happening in the world right now, and a lot of organizations pushing for, you know, stuff to go back to what it was. I've seen the workplace before COVID, and I see it now, and it's radically different. Yeah, it's important that we remember that we couldn't do what we do now, even just a couple of years ago. Technology-wise, and in terms of how we stay connected and how we collaborate remotely, and I think that's like a big evolution as well. And nobody knows the answer yet. I know that there's a lot of organizations that are embracing remote work. A lot of them are, you know, calling it hybrid, but really it isn't, because there's a lot of pressure for employees to go back to the workplace.
Yeah.
It's evolving, it's changing, and it hasn't really landed anywhere yet. But you can see that we are in the middle of a huge transformation. I've done coaching for 2 years straight, only remotely.
Okay, and
right, and it was unthinkable before. And all of a sudden the world opened up to me, you know, like I could coach anywhere in the world. And it wasn't a thing before. I used to ride my motorbike to, you know, the different offices of my clients in London and go and coach people. And I had to factor in traveling time, and nobody even considered, you know, like doing coaching on Zoom. It wasn't that frequent. And now it's more like norm, right? You do coaching online, and then, you know, there are some weirdos that are doing it face-to-face, you know? So, not that I consider them weirdos. I actually think it's precious to do coaching face-to-face, but you know what I mean, right?
Yeah, absolutely, because people did not know that it could be done. There was a new territory for them. And now, because they were forced into it, doing everything online, they realized, okay, this is also something that can be done, and it is as effective. And
I didn't mean to interrupt. Sorry, finish your thought.
Saves so much time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does. And consider individual differences. I am seeing more and more, I mean, this is anecdotal, but I am seeing more and more that it's very difficult for introverted people to go back to the workplace. And they perform better if they are given the space and time to be by themselves and focus. You know, like I'm old. I lived through a time also of going from having your room,
yeah,
to all of a sudden going into, you know, big spaces, you know, full of desks, to hot desks, you know, where you don't even have a desk anymore. That's how, you know, the office evolved. But yeah, I've lived through that. And, you know, and that changes dynamics, but not as much as all of a sudden realizes there are alternative ways to contribute. And it hurts me to see how certain organizations cannot see this. Some people thrive working remotely and some don't. Collaboration, yes, happens in real time in the office, but if we're all on Zoom all the time, and if the space doesn't allow you to collaborate, what's the point, right? And consider neurodiversity as well. Like, again, talking about individual differences, there's so many people that struggle to focus in these gigantic hot desking spaces, and they're so much more focused and successful from a performance point of view if they can have their own, you know, their own space. And once again, we're ignoring all of that in the public debate, I think.
Yeah, that is so true. And it's also very important to get this in, you know, conversation, so it becomes more of a normal thing around the corporate world. So my last question would be, because we are discussing about the future, is there any like emerging trend or the untapped area still in organizational psychology that you believe will maybe, you know, significantly impact the corporate world or revolutionize the landscape in the coming next decade, or let's say 5 years?
Jamil, as a discipline, if I have something on my radar that is going to revolutionize the workplace, no, not that I know of. If anybody knows, please tell me. I think it's a gigantic subject, right? And there's a lot of research and there's a lot of stuff happening, but I don't particularly know of anything that is going to sort of revolutionize, you know, the world of work, and even less so coming from organizational psychology. Into to a certain extent, that's also why some years ago I pivoted towards coaching psychology, because I thought that nobody can take that away from me, you know, like in a sense, those are skills that you learn for yourself and improve the way that you work with your client so much, because they give you like so much power through developing your listening skills, your consultative skills, your ability to take distance, right, and to center yourself. And you know, that's a recommendation that I would give to anyone. You know, like even I have studied supervision 6 years ago, and I have I've had a supervisor ever since. And organizational psychologists are usually not required to have a supervisor, and I think that's a gigantic mistake. And so I decided to find one for myself so that I could have like a soundboard, right? Like a professional like me, but that give me like a solid soundboard in a lot of matters. And no, I don't expect organizational psychology to revolutionize, you know, the world of work, but that doesn't mean that I think less of it. I still think that a lot of the stuff that you learn as a psychologist, as an organizational psychologist, is essential to doing a good job. It's not the only way, but it is a very good way to be a people professional. And yeah, and I can only hope that, you know, the research that we're doing into well-being, for example, that is so popular right now, is going to take more and more like a relevant place in the debate, thanks to the research that some organizational psychologists are pushing. But maybe, yeah, that's where the future lies more than anything else, in continuing to advocate for the personal experience, like in a humanistic sort of person-centered approach, because everything else will be taken over by the machines.
But what I think is, although it would be taken over by the machines, but the human-centered thing is machines cannot really, you know, innovate or create new things like humans can. So the creative part would be left with the humans. And if you're not creative enough, you're not like pushing yourself to think further, and you are more in the manual work, you would definitely be replaceable. But if you are a person who can actually make an impact by creating something, then machine is not really going to take your job anytime soon.
Yeah, or if you can listen, you know, if you're a human being that can listen and hold a space for someone else, I mean, that's invaluable. So
yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So, Gabriel, this has been such an amazing conversation, from you being the Professor Gab to the, as you say, to the corporate Gab. You have touched upon a lot of things, and I believe even for myself, it has given me a good glimpse into what reality is and how the corporate world is going with organizational psychology and how it needs to evolve. So thank you so much for such huge, huge wisdom of yours and sharing your experiences.
No, thank you. And I'm very passionate about some of these topics. So I hope people have registered that I am Italian. And so we always have like 150% more passion about the stuff that we believe in than any other country in the world. So sorry if I have been like, you know, very assertive on some of my opinions. But yeah, I hope that sharing my experience helps. And thank you for having me.
And there you have it. Another episode of Psych and Success, packed with insights and real-world advice on business psychology, Gen Z, evolving workplace dynamics, culture, AI, and so much more. If you want to stay ahead of the curve and dig deep into the fabric of modern work, you know what to do. Hit that follow button, share this podcast with your network, and drop us a review on Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever you tune in. Your feedback not only supports us, but also helps us connect with more inquisitive minds like yours. By the way, if you're looking to get in touch with today's guest, I've got you covered. Check out the description for their contact details. And if you feel inspired to chat directly with me about these compelling subjects, you can book a quick call through my Calendly or shoot me an email. All the links are in the description. This is your host, Kritika Kashyap, reminding you that the future of work is here and it's evolving fast. So let's explore it together. Until next time.